Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to Screen Geeks Radio episode... Is this 87?
I think so.
Okay, I hope so. This is Dave.
This is Barry.
This is Ethan.
Just waking up over there. He's got the soothing rainfall to calm him to sleep.
Exactly. And Josh and Melissa are at a double feature of Julie and Julia and G-Force. So, yeah, good luck on
More
that
power
one.
To them.
Yeah.
Or something. Julie and Julia would be great in digital 3D, though. With all the food. Oh, my gosh.
Okay, we'll get there. We will get there.
Yes.
All right, let's start off with, as usual, what did we watch this week? Ethan, I'll let you kick things off.
Okay, wow. I watched a lot this week, actually. So, yeah, not very productive on anything else except movie watching.
In this case, that's a good
You've
thing.
You've come to the right place.
For the first time in a long time, I revisited Poltergeist.
Did you say Poltergeist or Poltrygeist?
Poltergeist.
Okay, just wanted to make sure.
And the thing I found interesting about the movie, the most interesting, is that there's a scene where, well, obviously there's a lot of controversy over the violence and gore in the movie, but there's a scene where Craig T. Nelson and
Jo Beth Williams,
the wife in the movie, they're smoking pot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, wow, that must have been pretty risque back in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
Especially it was kind of a... Well, I guess it's not really a kids movie, but it's, you know, it's a Spielberg-produced movie. And anyway, are any of the sequels good?
Gosh. 2 is the closest to the first one. 3, Dave and I have... argued about for years because, like, I
that is
find
one of
it,
the funniest movies of all time.
I think it's really creepy, but Dave has never found the creepiness in it. You know, and I'll admit it's not a good movie at all. But the whole notion of, like, looking in the mirror and, like, your reflection is doing stuff that you're not doing, that always creeped me out. And Poltergeist 3 was the first movie I ever saw that did that. But it's not a good movie. I'll be the first to admit Poltergeist 3 is not good, but I still like it better than 2, even though 2 has good special effects, but it's got, like, this Indian mysticism angle to it that is just so goofy. The guy who played the silent Indian in Cuckoo's Nest plays a silent Indian in Poltergeist 2 who comes and tries to save the family from
Talk
evil,
about typecasting.
Evil Preacher Kane. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Wait, I actually think I may have seen it then.
Yeah, you might have. Yeah, there's
that sounds familiar.
Yeah, there's a scene where Craig D. Nelson, like, pukes up a demon. There's actually somebody in the credits who's listed as, like, the vomit creature. Yeah, because Craig T. Nelson, like, gets possessed by the house, and then he literally vomits up this big slimy creature that, like, it's not good. It's not good. No, just see the first one. Don't bother with the sequels.
Toby Hooper.
No, let's see. I can't remember who did the second one, but the third one is. Can't remember the names all of a sudden. The third one was the guy who did Wanted Dead or Alive, and yeah. But no. Yeah, Spielberg and Hooper didn't do the 2 or 3.
Okay.
They're not good.
I also revisited Planet of the Apes, the original, of course.
Ah, yes.
That movie, it holds up pretty well, I have to say.
It's nice when you take technology out of the equation. It's funny how many movies can really hold up well.
And when you have a leading man who, you know, is the center of the film. Because if that Tim Burton movie has one key problem, there's no center. Wahlberg is an observer. He's not a participant in his own movie.
Only one key problem?
I would say one big problem. Because I think if they fixed that, I think the movie would have been so much better. But, you know, I mean, let's face it.
Heston
is very good in Planet of the Apes. He's very good. So.
I really wish that, you know, the Simpsons episode where Troy McClure is doing Planet of the Apes the musical, I really wish that was real. Really.
Nice.
Also, I checked out Martin Scorsese's After Hours.
Oh, yeah. What'd you think?
Yeah, very good movie. Anytime Terry Garr is in a movie, it's a big plus for me. Yeah, it was good. It must have been pretty risque for its time, too, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, for 85. So you're a big Terry Garr fan?
Yeah.
That's cool. So yeah, am I.
She was an attractive woman.
All right, then.
I watched The Last Emperor.
I'm sorry.
Which I know, Dave, didn't I think when you watched it, you watched like the 3.5 hour cut?
Something like that, yeah.
The one I watched was 2 hours 45.
Okay,
so
you saw the theatrical cut. Yeah.
Yeah, and I thought it was pretty good. It was kind of like at first I was kind of like when it's like the guy's like, "Oh, Majesty, this is your lucky cricket." I was like, "Really? This is the last emperor?" But I thought it got better as it went on. So, yeah.
It really Plus loses David me once Burke. It goes to him being an adult. That's where it kills me.
All the stuff in Forbidden City is pretty amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. I was kind of surprised it was in English, too.
Mm-hmm.
I was expecting it to be subtitled.
Yeah, but, yeah, American film, and it won Best Picture in 1987. Although, I got to say, of all the movies that came out that year, I still think RoboCop is the best picture of 1987. Seriously do.
Completely. Yeah. It's pretty cool that David Byrne did the score.
Yeah, it's a beautiful score. I love that music.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I have one movie I crossed off my list of shame, Do the Right Thing.
Oh.
Now, which version did you watch, the Criterion or the regular?
I rented it on iTunes, so I guess you could just say it's the regular. Okay.
Did it have like the red filter to everything on it? Like all the scenes?
It had Rosie Parade dancing to Public Enemy.
Okay, so you saw a theatrical cut. What'd you think?
What was I going to talk about? Oh, the quote things at the end, you know, with...
Yes, yeah, Luther King and Malcolm X, yeah.
Yeah, I was reading how it seems lately that Spike Lee has kind of sided with Malcolm X's quote in the movie, and people are kind of, they're trying to maybe thinking what he was saying at the movie was a little like more leaning on one side than the kind of the even-handed approach. But don't you think that's really just Spike Lee? That, you know, he's changed as a person in the last 20 years. He's seen things that have and experienced things that have just made him be a different person than the one he was when he made Do the Right Thing. Don't you think? Like I think the movie itself is still pretty even-handed.
Yeah, I think 20 years later, you know, with 9/11 and with the world changing the way it does, I can't imagine him having the same. Well, even when it came out, he said there are days where he kind of wavers between the two, you know, ways of thought of Malcolm X being active and taking change in the world, or Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., someone who is so much more pacifist in his approach. Although I know Lee has said many times that with a black president, he feels so much more hopeful about the outcome of the world now than he used to. But, I don't know. Well, aside from the quotes, what else did you think about the movie? Because, I mean, I agree with you. I think the movie kind of, it never really takes sides. It kind of really leaves it up to the viewer to attach themselves to whoever's on screen. But what did you think of the film?
Well, I thought it was pretty awesome overall. Like, it was a good just depiction of race relations, and it wasn't too like heavy handed about it. I felt like it never. I was really glad. I kept thinking through the movie there was going to be some point where someone was just going to basically spell out everything that was kind of the movie was saying, but it just let the actions speak for themselves. Well, I guess it kind of those aforementioned quotes, but yeah, it's very good. It definitely holds up. I like that guy.
Yeah. I really appreciated the fact that it wasn't just, you know, stupid, ignorant, racist white people. It's everybody has an issue in their community no matter what. It's not like racism belongs to one certain heritage, I'll put it that way.
No. And the great thing about the ending is not only does Mookie incite the riot. I mean, let's face it, what happened was terrible. A riot was going to happen. But not only does Mookie incite it, Spike Lee incites the riot because he's playing Mookie. So Lee is saying that, look, we're all responsible for this horrible crap that happened. And it's like, you know, the questions keep going. I mean, couldn't Radio Raheem have turned down his damn radio? But, you know, did he have to? I mean, like, you know, again, this is a movie that asks all these questions. It doesn't say, well, this happened because this is injustice. No, I mean, these people are overworked, they're hot, they're tired, they're pissed, and they're racist, and look at the stupid things that they're doing to each other.
Absolutely. So. All right, what else you got, sir?
Just two last things, I promise. I rewatched The Hurt Locker.
Okay.
But this time in the theater instead of on a laptop screen.
Uh-huh.
And I'll say it's interesting when you watch movies, often your first viewing is kind of the visceral one, and the second one's the one where you see all the subtext.
Yeah.
But obviously this was kind of rearranged, and it kind of made me appreciate the movie even more. It's a real just kind of perfect movie in a lot of ways, like in how it's made and the tension and just the meaning and the character development. And I really hope that Jeremy Renner is nominated for Best Actor in a leading role at the Teen Choice Awards next year.
But you know, but he'll lose to Robert Pattinson because we've got a Twilight movie coming out this year.
That's right. Hey, we got to honor those acting heavyweights. We just do.
Okay, what's your last one, Ethan?
And I finally saw Valkyrie.
What'd you think?
I thought it was pretty good. I thought Tom Cruise's performance as Nick Fury was fine. it was a little different than I expected it to be. Like, I thought I figured it'd be kind of the movie would climax in the failed assassination. Like, it would just end, and then Hitler would come and be like, you didn't do it. And then they'd, like, kill them all. But it happened more in the second act. And then the good chunk of the third act was just kind of them operating under the misconception that Hitler had died.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was actually really interesting. And, yeah, it was pretty good.
I'm glad you liked it, because I remember how you unloaded a month ago for Vanilla Sky. So I'm glad you like Valkyrie.
There it is.
All right.
I guess I'll go next. I too finally crossed a movie off my list of shame. I actually bought it. But I finally got The Seventh Seal off my list of shame. And nice. That is a phenomenal movie.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot to think about after you watch that film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's good. It's actually, I'm maybe going to get some hate mail for this. It's probably my least favorite Bergman movie.
What is your favorite?
Probably Hour of the Wolf.
Oh, okay. Mine's Wild Strawberries, but yeah, a good pick.
That one's good too. I haven't seen like all his movies, but I bought it actually recently too. I plan on rewatching it, so yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I'm really impressed with it overall, because I mean, how sad is it that, oh goodness, why am I spacing on the lead actor's name?
Max von Sydow.
How sad is it that whenever the day that he passes, everyone's going to know him as the bad guy in Strange Brew? Like, he's such a great actor.
Especially in Canada.
Yeah? Yeah, especially. Okay, yeah, yeah. He put a little mouse in a bottle, eh? And yeah, okay. But he really is the emotional center to that film, and if he doesn't put out that performance, that film doesn't work at all. And it was just a fascinating film all over. There's plenty I'd like to ask about, but it'd be a huge spoiler, so I won't on the air.
Wait, what was I going to say? I was in a student movie with my drama teacher, who was in a movie with this guy who was in Strange Brew with Max von Sydow, who was in Minority Report with Tom Cruise, who was in A Few Good Men with Kevin Bacon.
And there it is.
Wow. I was tracking with you for a little bit. Then you said A Few Good Men, and I'm completely thrown off. Let's see. I'm not certain. Is it A Few Good Men?
Yeah, he was in a few. Wasn't he like kind of Jack Nicholson's? No way. Was he like kind of the what was it?
Maybe we should look this up on the break. A Few Good Men? That's the one that's the court case. Remember the military base?
Okay, Kevin Bacon was like the lawyer on the other side of
right.
The, yeah, I think that was.
Are you thinking of Kiefer Sutherland or?
No, Kevin. I'll check it right now for
Kevin Pollak.
Kevin Bacon is in it. Okay. So yeah, Kevin Bacon played the role of Captain Jack Ross in A Few Good Men.
Okay, but what we're trying to find out is who was the actor that was in Strange Brew and Minority Report and A Few Good Men that your actor teacher had worked with?
Yeah, okay, because
this is the worst game of Six Degrees ever.
I am so tired right now, I can't think. Okay. Von Sydow was in Minority Report with Tom Cruise.
Right.
A Few Good Men, Kevin Bacon. Max von Sydow was in Strange Brew, right? We're good here.
Yeah, yeah.
And I forget the name of the guy, okay? I'm not going to remember it off the top of my head. That's so just okay. Don't bug me about it.
So you're just trying to connect yourself 6 degrees to Max von Sydow.
Yes, to Kevin Bacon.
Oh, okay. Well, mission accomplished.
Yeah. I won't say how I've got it like in 2, but that's okay.
Yes, that is true. You've got like 2 degrees to most people, Dave.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
You were in Footloose, Dave?
Yes. I was on the pole. I don't know. Okay. No one wants to think
There's
about
no
that.
Pole and Footloose? You're thinking of Flashdance.
I haven't seen either one of them, so it's okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was just totally pulling that
out. I'll loan you my copy. They're good.
I'm okay. So I did that, and what else did I watch? I watched Chaplin, finally.
What'd you think?
I love that movie. Like, if I'd watched this like 5 years ago, I would have hated it. But since I've become a Charlie Chaplin fan, I thought I was absolutely engrossed by it. Robert Downey Jr. and his physical comedy chops, oh my gosh.
It's amazing. Amazing performance.
Yeah, when he first shows up on the studio and Dan Aykroyd's like, I didn't hire some kid. I hired the greatest wino of all time. And he just goes into his shtick, and it's freaking awesome.
It always pissed me off that not only did Al Pacino beat Denzel Washington for Best Actor for Malcolm X. Yeah, for that performance, but he also beat Downey Jr. for Chaplin. Brilliant performances, but, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, his performance of Son of a Woman beat them both. Couldn't believe it.
That's sad. And then finally, I bought Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog at Best Buy yesterday. And
Mr. Whedon.
Yeah, we watched Commentary the Musical. I almost said Cannibal the Musical for some reason. But Commentary the Musical is freaking hilarious and is well worth the price of purchase by itself because it's like $10.
I'll have to give that a listen.
But yeah, that's about all I got this week. Yeah. What have you got, sir?
I saw Killshot, the long-released Elmer Leonard thriller with Diane Lane and Mickey Rourke. It's worth seeing because Mickey Rourke and Joseph Gordon-Levitt are fantastic, and they play a couple killers. They're great in that. The movie itself is not that great, and it's definitely not Diane Lane's best performance by a long shot. Let's see. I saw All About Eve, which I've always wanted to see. With
the
Betty
Davis movie? That's a crazy
terrific
movie.
Terrific movie. One of the creepiest endings I think I've ever seen. Really creeped me out. I wasn't expecting to creep me out as much as it did, but it did. The Hawaiians with Charlton Heston, sequel to Hawaii, great film, great movie, available on Hulu, not available on VHS or DVD. Eyewitness, even though it has Sigourney Weaver, William Hurt, Christopher Plummer, and Morgan Freeman and James Woods, not a good movie, came out in the 80s. Wow. Yeah, investigative reporter movie, totally forgettable. And the one I saw just because Ethan inspired me to see it because I hadn't seen it in years and years and years. I watched The Sting and Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid back to back.
Nice.
I thought you were going to say Freddy Got Fingered.
I hate that movie. I hate that movie so much.
The Sting. Go back to
The Sting. Yes.
I'm helping you.
Sorry.
Take out the.
I just remember my students like talking about great comedy. One of them raised their hand like, "Have you seen Freddy Got Fingered?" I'm like, "No." And then they started to go, "Daddy, would you like some sausage?" They started to do like scenes from
See,
the movie.
See, that's hilarious.
I hate that. Anyway, so yeah, I watched The Sting because Ethan brought it up last episode. And now I still like Butch Cassidy better. I think Butch Cassidy is a total masterpiece. The Sting is fantastic. Yeah. I just think even for 70s movies, I think it's a little too long. Like, I think it could have been tightened. It's about 130 minutes. I don't think it needed to be quite as long as it is. You know, in a lot of 70s movies, you know, they're very slow-paced and they take their time. But this one I thought was just a little too long. But, yeah, excellent film. And I totally agree with you. Like, they're so magnetic, Redford and Newman. Yeah, great film.
Cool. All right. Well, let us talk about what came out in theaters this week.
Wait. Before we do that, was that student who mentioned Freddy Got Fingered Josh?
No, actually, this is the first class I ever taught, a film class, back in 2000. It was a high school class, and, you know, I was trying to, like, engage them about, like, Billy Wilder and Mel Brooks, you know, great film comedy, and, you know, kid in the front row, I don't remember his name, but I remember his face. I remember just the enthusiasm. Did you see Freddy Got Fingered? And my heart just sank, and I thought, I don't know if I could do this as a living. So it really crushed my soul to hear him say that. No, it was not Josh. So, all right, hit theaters this week. Julie and Julia with Meryl Streep and Amy Adams, the new film from Nora Ephron. G.I. Joe, not screened for the critics, but still starring Channing Tatum. I can't say his name.
Because no one cares, because his biggest movie before this was Never Back Down, Never Surrender.
Wait, Tatum O'Neill?
And Joseph Gordon-Levitt is also in the film.
And Christopher Eccleston.
Christopher Eccleston as Destro. That's right. And then A Perfect Getaway with Mila Jovovich and Steve Zahn, which I've heard great things about. Have you read the reviews on this?
I haven't.
They say it's got like one of the great twist endings of the year.
Okay.
And it takes place on the island of Kauai, but it was obviously filmed in Puerto Rico. I've heard that's not a good thing about it. But yeah, I've heard it's a real sleeper. People are really liking it.
So obviously Mila Jovovich's husband did not direct this film.
Ooh.
I didn't even know that they were married until like this week, so that kind of threw me off.
I think they broke up, actually.
Oh, did they?
No, yeah, I think they have a child.
Yeah, they have a kid, because she was pregnant when I saw her at Comic-Con in 07. But yeah, I think they've ditched each other.
Them being Paul Whatscript Anderson. So yeah, okay.
Yes, they.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, so here's the funny thing, folks. You can feel free to direct your hate mail to podcast@screengeeks.com. None of us saw G.I. Joe.
I will see it. I promise. I just haven't seen it yet. I'm thinking about seeing it at the drive-in next week. Cool. That's such a drive-in movie. You know? But no, I haven't seen it.
It is. I'd like to do that too, but the local drive-in, it's paired with Transformers 2. So
that's exactly what it's paired with over here. It's funny you say that. I was just going to go to the drive-in and then leave after the first feature.
There you go.
Yeah.
I just couldn't work up the gumption to actually care enough to go see it. Mm. I'll be really honest.
You just don't want to see it, period.
I'll see it at some point. I'm just... I don't know. Just
you don't want to see the follow-up film from the director of Van Helsing?
I've heard it's tons of fun, but you know, I don't know. I don't know why. I just have no desire to see it.
You don't want to see like Joseph Gordon-Levitt after his winning breakthrough performance in 500 Days of Summer? You don't want to see him.
I want to avoid Marlon Wayans. Okay, you made me say it.
Yeah, that's an excellent reason. Excellent reason.
Yeah, yeah. But you saw one of the movies that came out this week.
I did. I love Julie and Julia. I was really surprised. This is a real comeback for Nora Ephron. I don't think she's made a great movie since Sleepless in Seattle. The last few years you've got Mail, Bewitched, Mixed Nuts, Hanging Up. I mean, some real stinkers. But everything works in this movie. It's focused. It's low key, no question. But I thought the performances were wonderful. It made me extremely hungry. But I found this movie to be very inspiring. It's about basically excelling at what you love and basically finding your life goal after a lot of trial and error through life. I thought this movie was very inspirational. I thought it was very touching. I thought it was very funny. I walked out of it. I really couldn't think of anything about it I didn't like. I thought this was a fine film.
So is this like another Miss Pettigrew type situation where it's like something that you wouldn't.
Right. Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I did like it better than Miss Pettigrew, but that's a good film, too. But no, I really liked Julie and Julia a lot.
Okay, because honestly, I hear Nora Ephron, I'm like, okay, I'm kind of interested, and I hear Girls Cooking Obsession, Julia Child. What? Sorry.
It's the kitchen. It's where the women belong.
Oh, dude, that's Ethan at ScreenGeeks.com, folks.
That would be an interesting sequel title to What Women Want, Where Women Belong. like Mel Gibson's character digresses, he gets hit by lightning again, and now he's a total sexist. You might be onto something there, Ethan. Mel Gibson in Where Women Belong.
Oh, and Mel Gibson doing it too, that makes it even better, yeah.
Yeah, I can totally see that work. I think Ethan's onto something.
Oh, that's a bad place to go. Okay. What's hitting DVD, sir?
I Love You, Man, with Jason Segel and Paul Rudd. Very good film. 17 Again, one of the worst films of the year, starring Zac Efron and, to his shame, Matthew Perry. The Class.
Wait.
Yep.
Sorry. I was reminds me, a week ago, I'm in Toronto right now, but I was just in the airport, killing time before having dinner, and I overheard a conversation between two people working there where she was saying that she just saw The Ugly Truth, and it was the second best movie she saw all year, second to only 17 Again. So.
Was the woman Paris Hilton by any chance?
No, but she served me my chicken fingers.
Okay, moving along.
I would disagree with her on both counts. Yeah, 17 Again is terrible. The Class, the winner of the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival 2 years ago, supposed to be a great film, finally makes its way to DVD. And then Super Friends, The Lost Episodes, also on DVD.
Why are they lost?
There's probably a very good reason for
very
them
good.
Being lost.
And then the crap title of the week, sequel nobody wanted, Road Trip 2, Beer Pong, unrated cut. This was never in theater, by the way. This is not a theatrical release. This is one of those straight-to-DVD monstrosities.
I'm so shocked that someone would do that. Okay, not at all.
Wish they would leave Road Trip alone. The creme de la creme of Tom Green films. They need to leave this film alone.
The fact that there's a creme de la creme of Tom Green films.
There is. This is it. Just,
yeah,
this is it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I will agree with you, but yeah.
Well, oh, you know what? Charlie's Angels? Is it better than Charlie's Angels? No, there is a conundrum. Did you like Charlie's Angels?
I do.
I thought it was a guilty pleasure. I liked it.
Yeah, the first one. Yeah, 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 yeah.
I like the part in Freddy Got Fingered where his like friend is like skateboarding and he falls and like he breaks his bone. It's what's it called again when the bone sticks out?
Compound fracture.
Yeah, and Tom Green starts licking the bone.
Okay. See, now I will never ever see this movie.
It's a good part.
I've never sang creme de la creme of Tom Green movies again. I deserve that Freddy Got Fingered reference.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
That's it for DVD releases.
Okay, let's go ahead and get into some news. I think Ethan and I are on this, so we will just trade back and forth. I'll end with my article last, I guess. So why don't you go first, Ethan?
It's been a long time coming. Ben Lyons, Ben Mankiewicz.
You know, I have a sound, you know, just for that. Because that deserves applause right there. There is justice in the world. The talentless, the mundane don't always end up sticking around. And thank Pez for that.
This is one of the cruelest episodes we ever recorded. But no, it's true. We are celebrating the firing of two film critics from
the And here's the thing. I don't have as much of a problem with Mankiewicz as I did with Lyons.
Yeah.
Mankiewicz wasn't all that great either, but worlds above Lyons.
I mean, let's just be honest. These guys were not as good as Richard Roper and the rotating guests that he would have every week.
Exactly. Now who's replacing them, Ethan?
A.O. Scott, Michael Phillips. I just want to note, A.O. Scott is like my number one man crush. So,
all right.
A.O. Scott's got talent. I've read his reviews. I like him. Even when I disagree with him, he's a very good writer. And that's, I think, a sign of a good critic right there.
Very cool. Right on. So, yeah, I would say it's been nice having you on the show. But thank goodness they're off. Because I'd watch that show just to put myself into a mental shock for some reason or something. I don't know. So, okay, I'll go with the next story here. I'm actually going to do a twofer just because it's a couple trailers and they're both really good. First of all, we've got the UK Dr. Parnassus trailer. Barry hasn't seen it yet because you want to go into this as unspoiled as possible.
If I can help it, yeah. If it's not going to come out till next year, then I'll watch it. But if it's opening like in a month or two, then I'll try to restrain myself.
You saw this, right, Ethan?
Yes, and I have a very special thing to say about it.
Oh, okay. I'm scared.
Terry Gilliam makes Tim Burton shit in his pants.
I saw it. Was it on Ain't It Cool? Or no, it was on Slash Film. Someone said that Tim Burton is the poor man's Terry Gilliam.
Completely.
That's mean.
But it kind of works.
Terry Gilliam, you know, the difference is that Tim Burton has studio backing for his crazy visions.
Exactly.
No matter what he wants.
He's a hired gun.
No. He has people who support him.
A studio has a property. They have like the Care Bears movie or a Captain Crunch movie, and they're like, "Let's get Tim Burton to do it. Why not?" Hey,
Burton has not made the Care Bears movie or the Captain Crunch movie.
I can so see that him doing a Captain Crunch movie with Johnny Depp. I can so see that. Opening up in like IMAX 3D.
But only he would make it good. Only he would make a good Captain Crunch movie.
It would be entertaining, but it wouldn't be more than a Captain Crunch movie.
Oh, for Pete's sake.
Wow, I wasn't going to go there, but dang.
My whole point is that Gilliam has nobody to back his visions. He has to go out of his way, like the maverick he is.
Because he takes risks. He's a visionary.
Tim Burton takes risks. Nobody liked
in the mascara that his actors wear.
Nobody liked Mars Attacks. Nobody saw Ed Wood.
I love Mars Attacks. And I like Ed Wood.
Not every one of his movies are studio backed. You know, unfortunately, audiences also turned out for Planet of the Apes, even though that was completely uninspired.
I'm staying out of this. I'd like everyone to note that I'm not getting in on this discussion because Dave had his time last week. Yeah. Okay.
It's funny you say this because I do actually like Tim Burton, but it's just I don't know
if you compare the two though. I mean, come on. It's like I remember when everybody was saying that M. Night Shyamalan was the next Steven Spielberg. I thought, what an insult to the both of them. because M. Night Shyamalan can't possibly live up to that. He's only done three movies.
Yeah, and he's one's white, one's Indian. Jeez.
And one did Happening, and one did Indiana Jones 4.
Right, and the Happening is far worse, Dave.
It is. That's just because that Shyamalan didn't have the same CG budget. That's all. Sorry, that was a joke. That was a joke.
Ooh.
But okay, Dave, what did you think of didn't they shoot all those effects naturally, like the first three movies? Even that pissed me off.
Okay, so what did you think of the Imaginarium Dr. Parnassus trailer, Ethan?
That was pretty much my opinion.
Okay. Yeah, it is truly... It in some ways, some people have said this is what we've seen from Terry Gilliam before, but I see that as a true compliment because he does have such a unique vision that, yeah, it looks really good.
Do all the other performances, like Depp and Law, look
they good? Seem pretty organic to the progression of the story just from the trailer. I mean, obviously, right. There's only so much you can tell from a trailer, because even if you wanted to, you couldn't tell the entire story of a Terry Gilliam movie in a trailer. So thank God for that.
Yeah.
And then secondly, we have the new Where the Wild Things Are trailer, and I'm even more sold on this movie.
I will openly weep during this movie when I see it in the theater.
I get that feeling too.
Yeah. It looks wonderful. It really does. I hope it lives up to the trailers. I really do.
Yeah, what I liked was the first trailer kind of established, you know, the world that they're going to do, and the second one kind of lets you in on the story a little bit, and I'm so there, opening day.
Can we believe that the song that's in the trailer is going to be in the movie since
Arcade
it was
Fire?
Two trailers?
Yeah. I think it has to be.
It's a beautiful song. Like, it's got to be in the movie. They had it in two trailers, for Pete's sake.
Yeah,
and they re-recorded the song for the trailer, too, because on the original album, it's a bit more rock. It's a bit more...
Yeah, that's on the Funeral CD, right?
Yeah,
I grabbed funeral, that, yeah. And it's first album. It's good stuff. It's
a masterpiece of an album. Yeah. Mm.
Yes, so yeah, I can't wait for either of those movies. So, Ethan, go ahead and go for it, sir.
Speaking of trailers, the trailer for Peter Jackson's A Lovely Bones has come out. Guys, thoughts?
Looks very unique.
I'm not sure this concept is going to work as a movie, but I am curious to see it.
I read the book. Have anyone else?
I have not. What'd you think of the book?
I only read it to get chicks, but
that didn't how'd that work out so. For you?
Didn't work out too well. So
would chicks be attracted to The Lovely Bones?
No, chicks love that book. I swear. Anytime I'm on Facebook, and they're like, it's like every girl I know like lists that on their favorite books. It's ridiculous. Hmm. But yeah. It was a good book. It was flawed, but it was interesting. And I think the trailer though is, I think, kind of mis-selling the movie a little bit.
Okay,
because they're kind of playing up the thriller aspect in the second half, and it that's really like a very small part of the book. So, okay. But that's really just to hook audiences, I guess. So
I like the trailer, but since you've read the book, do you think this is going to work well as a Peter Jackson film? Could it work well?
I can see it, yeah. Like, I definitely hope there's some zombies in it.
Some lawnmowers.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sumatran rat monkeys.
Does the trailer give away too much?
No, not at all.
No, because you don't know
Tucci
anything.
Tucci is, like, you know that Tucci is the bad guy from, like, the first page of the book. So.
Okay, okay. Because I was worried, like, is this a spoiler? Because I mentioned that trailer to the movie, I think it was called Brothers, with... Gyllenhaal and Natalie Portman mm-hmm. would like summarize the entire movie in 2 minutes, like the ending and everything.
So I don't need to go to the preview screening for that. Is that what you're saying?
I could write my review right now.
Oh, dang. Okay. Where do I want to go next? Oh, you know, this is kind of video game news, but it is Avatar related. It's interesting. You'd think people would think more about decisions they make for marketing. The announcement has come out that the Avatar game, I think it's going to be on PS3 as well as 360, is going to be in 3D. Kinda.
Mm.
It will be available in 3D if your 360 or PS3 has an HDMI port on it, which knocks out about half at least of the Xbox 360s that don't have it. And you have a TV that has to be at least 120 hertz, which I don't think they even started selling till like this year. So unless you're on the cutting, bleeding edge, you won't be able to play this game in 3D. How is this a good idea? I just don't get that. I don't know. It just seems like, yeah, we're going to put it on the cutting edge, and if you can't keep up with that, tough. It's just kind of silly. Yeah, that's all. Yeah. And that's all I got about that.
I hear the game, though, is going to have an exclusive, like, you can, if you buy the game, you can get the
Celine Dion single for free on iTunes.
And how's that song going to go, Ethan?
Okay, can't do it anymore.
What I love is that actually, listeners, Ethan actually sang the whole song, but it's so terrible that it only sounded like feedback.
Yeah. I don't even know where to go with that. Yeah. If it was to do it with Will Smith, that's the only way it could be any better.
That would be good, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, you have the feedback and then him dropping his hip hop over a DJ Jazzy Jeff riff. Yeah, it's all good. I don't know why I went there. Okay, Ethan, back to you, sir. Do whatever news you got left. I'm going to end up...
only one story left. Looks like this is just a rumor at this point, but, you know, who knows? Spielberg, he might be producing Halo.
And how could that possibly go wrong? Taking over for Peter Jackson, as in Peter Jackson won't be involved anymore.
Or Neil Bloop.
Blomkamp, yeah.
Bleep Boop, or...
Do we know who the director is? Or just that Spielberg's producing? Oh. Well, I wonder what Michael Bay is doing next year.
Oh, come on.
I will
on.
Say about Transformers 3, I will see it if it has this exact plot, that there's these Autobots that go bad because like they're families of Autobots that died in battle haven't gotten like compensation, so they like take Alcatraz like for hostages there, and they steal these nuclear weapons, and there's like this old Autobot they need to get who escaped from Alcatraz and stuff to like help them get it back. And there's like a scene with Megan Fox as a control room watching everything happen. She like puts her like hands over her face and stuff, and the subtitle will be The Stone.
Wow. And there it is. That's a good ripoff of another Michael Bay movie, sir.
That's a good trailer in my head. Very nice, man.
Yeah.
I've got a story. I didn't mention it before, but let me just say this.
How did we space?
John Hughes died.
Oh, I feel stupid.
This is one of my favorite directors, and it's like one of these guys, you don't even realize he's one of your favorite directors until you list his, until you list Weird Science and National Lampoon's Vacation and The Breakfast Club, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, Home Alone. Some of these movies, of course, that he just wrote. He didn't direct all of those films. But he did direct Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. And he did direct
Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
And Weird Science.
Blubber.
And Some Kind of Wonderful and Pretty in Pink. One of the great ones. He hasn't directed a film since Curly Sue in 1991. However, he has written a lot since then. He was going to direct Made in Manhattan. It was originally written as a vehicle for Julia Roberts. That fell apart, and he backed out of the film, and Ghost basically slapped a fake name onto the screenplay, and then it became a Jennifer Lopez film. But I heard for years he was going to do a sequel or a remake to The Breakfast Club, and that never happened, which is probably a good thing.
Now, have you guys read that article about the girl who corresponded with him like over 20 years? Essentially, there's some girl who wrote to him after The Breakfast Club and saying, this is amazing. She got some form letter back and was like, I poured my heart out to you. What's wrong with you? Then he wrote back and said, this isn't a form letter. And they kind of had a relationship going for like 10 or 20 years. And apparently, he left Hollywood because he was worried about what effect it'd have on his kids. And I'll find the story. It's all over the web, but I'll post it in the show notes. And it's really touching. It's well worth reading.
Yeah. Anyway, our thoughts and prayers go out to his family. He will truly be missed. This is one of my favorites. Can't believe he's gone.
Yeah. Absolutely. And finally, speaking of Steven Spielberg.
I love hearing Dave give...
I don't even know where to start with this. Okay, the man wants to remake Harvey for some reason. And I don't know why.
Did you just hear this? But I heard that apparently it's looking like Will Smith will probably play the Cary Grant role.
Jimmy Stewart, you mean?
Yeah, or same thing. But... No, not same thing. I'm sorry. Okay, just relax. what do you think of that? Will Smith is.
I can't think of any actor who could pull off what Jimmy Stewart did. Least of all being Will Smith, because I'm sorry, Jimmy Stewart never said, "Oh hell no."
Will Smith can certainly act, but I can't see that. I just can't imagine that. It's just, this is a story for its time. I think today, if somebody, is talking to a, 7 foot tall talking rabbit.
6 foot six.
6 foot six, excuse me. I think I just can't see it being as whimsical and cute as it was
I can't see someone trying to pull off that same innocence in today's day and age.
Spielberg, in theory, is the right guy to do this. He did a remake of A Guy Named Joe called Always a few years ago. It's not his best film, but it's one of his sweetest, and it certainly tonally fits with that kind of movie. Spielberg also did another Frank Capra-like movie called The Terminal, which did not turn out so well. I fear that this will turn out like that. This is just one of these stories that, you know, it's like Spielberg on one hand is a big kid, and he's someone who walks around, you know, with you know, he's someone who lives in his imagination, and that is the James Stewart character. That is the relationship that he has with the rabbit.
The imagination that he's still a good filmmaker? Sorry.
He could still direct films. He could still make a good film, but I'm with you, Dave. I wish he would get onto the Lincoln film he's been talking about for making for years.
But at this rate, we know he's just going to remake Young Mr. Lincoln. You know, that's what I'm expecting at this point.
Wait, but who's going to play the – like, you just know they're going to have, like, some actor in, like, a motion capture suit play the rabbit.
And that's the thing. There is no freaking rabbit in the movie.
You're not supposed to see the rabbit. I've seen Harvey Dent as a stage play a few years ago.
And that's how it originated.
Yeah, and that's, you know, again, you're not supposed to see the rabbit. It's supposed to be endearing because of the relationship he has with this imaginary creature. You're not supposed to see the creature. It's not about the creature. This is not Roger Rabbit.
Let me ask. Go ahead, Ethan.
Will Smith, as in the Jimmy Stewart role, Zach Galifianakis as the rabbit.
There you go.
You like it?
No.
You like the juice?
My question is there an actor working today who could pull this film off?
Sure, but I don't think they need to. You know?
Well, yeah, that's...
You know, it's like, I mean, could we find an actor who could play the Cary Grant role in a remake North by Northwest? Sure, but, you know, why do that?
I can't believe this didn't hit me. Tom Green.
I was thinking Joshua Jackson, but, you know.
That'd be too good. That's the problem.
How about Tom Green plays Harvey?
I just don't see.
I'd like to see him in a big bunny suit walking around, and you know, only Joshua Jackson can see him.
Yeah.
Oh my God! They're both Canadian too. It can be set in Ottawa.
And David Cronenberg could direct it.
Yes.
And William Shatner could be the psychiatrist.
And Broken Social Scene can write the score.
And Rachel McAdams could be the lead actress. Huh?
This and is going
they
could downhill
be they
so
could be
else.
Eating and they can be eating poutine.
And Mike Myers can narrate.
Oh.
And Dan Aykroyd could play the father.
Yeah, and Pierre Trudeau will rise from the grave and make a cameo.
This is the thing. This is going to become a joke. People say, "Hey, it's bringing the original film to the light for people to see." No, it's not. How many people went out and watched Charade after the atrocity that was The Truth About Charlie?
Yeah.
Unless they bought the DVD, which if they did, they were too stupid to actually realize that the original film was good.
Well, I think what they'll do is there'll be like a Blu-ray re-release of Harvey, and they'll say, the movie that inspired blank. And, you know, it's like I think Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. Didn't a lot of people see the original when the remake came out?
Yeah.
So, you know, that could happen.
No, this movie's going to blow.
Aw, Dave.
Well, we should see what the concept is and who the actor is, but... Yeah, I can't even. I mean,
as a man who's always said that he's such a bit, I'm regurgitating a bit from my article, so sorry, folks. Deal. As a man who's so much about film history, the man who got together with you know with Coppola and with Lucas to help Kurosawa fund his final two films, just having this true sense of history, why would you even try this? A guy named Joe. Is that the that's what
a guy always, named Joe?
Is that is the original on the par of like Harvey?
In a different way, yeah.
Okay.
And since it was a classic, yeah, in that sense.
Okay, so he's already set up that. Okay, yeah. I will say it again here. I'm officially done with Spielberg. If he makes this movie, I am done.
Well, here's the question. Wasn't he going to do an Old Boy remake with...
Yes, that's still on.
Will Smith? What happened to that?
It's still on.
It's still on. So he's going to do like all these Will Smith movies.
He's planning out the next 20 years, essentially.
Is Will Smith like his new Tom Cruise? He's going to do movies just with him?
Yeah. I guess. Wait, but I was just thinking, he has Tintin coming out, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, he and Jackson are working on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're co-directing it.
Seriously, I'm done. Like, the guy never directed a movie as far as I'm concerned.
I don't think he could do Young Mr. Lincoln just because Liam Neeson's playing Lincoln. So it has to be, you know, and plus, you know, the rumor is that, what's his name? The lead Goonie, I'm sorry, Josh...
Brolin.
Thank you. Josh Brolin is going to be playing John Wilkes Booth. So it's got to be, you know, it's got to be the latter years of Lincoln. So hopefully that'll work.
You know, at this point, I'll skip it.
Wait, but didn't like Josh Brolin already kind of do the John Wilkes Booth thing in Milk?
Typecasting.
Assassinating a well-renowned political figure. Yeah.
As I said in the article, I want to like Spielberg again because I know that he has been a good filmmaker, and I think
I don't want to be a jerk here, but it seems like you're kind of writing him off because of like two bad movies.
Two?
Well, Indiana Jones
and War of the Worlds
and The Terminal, and I mean, come on now.
Okay,
but even like I admit I haven't seen The Terminal, but I doubt it was anything really above mediocre. Like I'm sure it was very unoffensive. And just kind of and that's nothing really to get mad over.
Munich.
That was a good movie.
I hate that effing movie. There's no emotional center to even remotely latch on to.
No, Banna.
There's nothing to like in that movie.
There's Banna. He's so good in that movie when he's, you know, having sex in slow motion. He's like, and all the sweat's coming off.
Exactly.
You like Catch Me If You Can.
I do. That's like the one movie he's made out of the last 10 that I really, really liked.
Really?
Yeah.
You didn't like Hook?
That's past.
Jurassic Park?
Hang on. Let me pull this up here. Hang on just a sec. Okay, so I paused the show. I actually meant to say 10 years as opposed to his past 10 films because that's really where it comes from. Going from 2001, actually 1999, I didn't see Unfinished Journey. The last movie I liked of his that out of, okay, 1998 was Saving Private Ryan. That was like the last in like the string of movies of his that I really liked. After that, we've got AI. We won't regurgitate that. Minority Report, I didn't like. Catch Me If You Can, I will admit, I liked that film. I thought it was a great film. The Terminal, I hated. War of the Worlds sucked. Munich, I did not like. And Indiana Jones.
Okay, but look, but that those are what,
that's the past
six movies?
Movies? Yes, but that's like one for six out of the past 10 years.
But he's directed 20 films, right?
Oh, no, he's more than that.
Okay, well, look at all the older movies he did that you love. You know, the classics.
But the man's dropped off so hard.
But he can't come back?
Dude.
He can't come back?
Not with Harvey.
Because, as you said, Private Ryan, that is historical drama. I mean, don't you think Lincoln could be like a real big comeback?
It theoretically, I suppose it could be.
Tintin, if they say it's as amazing as it is, like another game changer visual effects, that could be like another Jurassic Park, another amazing special effects, you know, movie that, you know, things work.
I won't bring back that movie again. Because the last movie he did that had a lot of effects wasn't all that great either.
Fair enough.
And the man had some control over that. Don't blame it all on Lucas. He went along for the ride.
Oh, no. Well, everybody loves to dog Lucas, but
yeah,
it's not fair.
That is not a track record that gives me any faith in the man.
But the man did Jaws and Close Encounters. I mean,
he did.
You know,
how long ago?
Are you going to piss on Hitchcock because of Family Plot and Frenzy and Topaz? I mean, this guy still made, you know.
He also made a lot more good movies.
Yes, he did. But he made a lot more movies, let's be fair. I mean, Hitchcock, you know, he was making movies since, you know, before there was sound.
How hard was it, going back to Indiana Jones. How hard must it have been to screw up an Indiana Jones movie?
I think it would have been easy for him because he's at a darker place now. If we look at his filmography, he doesn't make those kind of movies anymore. So I think it was a mistake for him. Because let's face it,
okay,
it's easy for him to do something like Minority Report and AI and Munich, because that's where he is. Like, he's cynical. He's the wide-eyed Spielbergian glow is really out of his reach now.
Yeah, is he making Harvey?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, Shia swinging with the monkeys clearly represented how gritty he is now. And
but you say he's in a darker place.
Yep.
Harvey is not a dark movie.
Right.
If you make this a dark movie, give it to frickin' Tim Burton and let him flush it down the toilet.
Yeah,
because there's something screaming for a crazy goth guy. It's not Steven freaking Spielberg. I'm just saying. And I know you had a final point to wrap this up, Ethan.
You know, you're saying we were talking about E.T. Dave, you're not a fan of that movie, right?
Not even a little bit.
And you're saying how he had happened to replace guns with walkie-talkies.
I have brought that up.
And Barry said, you know, it doesn't matter if they replaced the guns with machetes, you still wouldn't have liked it.
Yeah.
Well, they could have replaced Henry Thomas with Will Wheaton, and you still wouldn't have liked it.
And that is completely fair, sir.
I freaking love E.T. E.T. and Return of the Jedi were the two movies that my father took me to all summer long that I just pretty much – those movies made me love movies, especially E.T. I still get teary-eyed when I watch E.T. the Extraterrestrial.
I think a lot of it comes from the fact that I have lost so much respect for Spielberg and how much I absolutely love and adore Harvey. I will fully admit that
Harvey's
bias.
A great film. It is a great film. It does not need to be remade. Why don't they go back and make movies that stunk?
Yes.
I mean, let's say
like,
some
I'm okay with Flight
stunk.
Of the Navigator because, you know, when it comes down to it, it's not a great film. It's a fun film.
It's a fun movie,
but it's
yeah.
right for a remake. Yeah.
It's funny you bring up Flight of Navigator. For some reason, I always thought that was Explorers, what Explorers was. Like when people brought up Flight of Navigator, I'm like, yeah, that was the movie. Yeah, with River Phoenix and the flying box or whatever.
You get weird looks and – well, maybe not.
Yeah.
Well, like, you know, Cronenberg, speaking of Cronenberg, I mean, he went back and remade The Fly. The Fly needed a remake. The Fly is not, you know – scripture that you know you can go back and redo The Fly. Why not do something like that?
That's a great question.
Why go to a Jimmy Stewart classic that every I mean next to Mr. Smith and next to It's
the
a Wonderful
Philadelphia
Life
story.
Philadelphia sure. Story, It's a Wonderful Life, and yeah, and Vertigo. Everybody has seen Harvey, you know. Why not go for the one that nobody saw, that Jimmy Stewart did, that nobody liked?
Do the musical that he did, for crying out loud, that no one's seen. They've seen like the one scene where he tries to sing, and then that's it. Okay, go remake that.
Poor guy. He's not a singer. But anyway, yeah, like why not do something like that? Just something that just did not work. Like Toby Hooper. Speaking of Toby Hooper, he did a remake of Invaders from Mars. Well, the remake was terrible. But still, at least he went back and tried to remake a movie, you know, that could have used remaking.
Yeah.
Go back and do the bad ones over again. It's like Gus Van Sant. It's like, I love Van Sant, but I don't understand why he felt the need to remake Psycho.
Shot for shot.
Yeah, it was just... and I know like his reason was because no one else did, but that's you know...
Well, about that, I don't think that movie... I think the thing about that movie, this is going to get off a bit of a tangent, though, is Van Sant's obviously a very experimental guy. Mm-hmm. I think that movie was more kind of meant as like a video project someone would do in college, but then like Universal got behind it and was like, no, let's release this in 3,000 theaters and give it a huge marketing campaign. When Van Sant's like, no, this is just my own personal experiment, but you know. So yeah, that's just kind of in defense of him.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. And maybe if they released it like as an art film or something, it would have been more accepted, but because they released it as wide as they did, and it was like the big event of that fall season. It's
yeah. Okay, let's take a break. I've gotten my rant out of the way.
This is gonna be a long show, isn't
it? It is. Because the game, I have a feeling, is not gonna take 5 minutes to talk about.
I guess we did do all the news. Yeah. And some Spielberg, so.
Yeah, yeah. And if you want to hear a less ranty version of my version of why Harvey shouldn't be remade, check ScreenGeeks.com. I've got an article about it.
It's a great article. You guys need to read it. Dave wrote a really good article. I said it in the chat rooms. I'll say it now. I was proud of him for not mentioning Indiana Jones. He kept it. It was a very focused article. It's very good.
Woohoo! Yes. So. Okay, let's take a quick break, but then we will be right back to talk about David Fincher's The Game.
Sue Ellen Greenblatt is a real person, not an internet celebrity. So we've enlisted Billy Flynn and the Vicar to help her tell her story.
Geek Radio Daily gives me geeky news about movies, new DVD releases, even comics and gaming.
Geek Radio Daily makes me feel special.
Ah, yeah.
Womanly.
Yeah.
Okay, so the episodes are just 15 minutes, perfect for my commute or for just geeking out while I'm at the office.
Mm. All in one concise love package.
Ooh, the package, baby.
Uh-huh. And the best part is that it's a daily cast, so I'm always in the loop.
Sometimes I listen to it out of the bath, put on little outfits.
It makes me want to invite all my friends over to show how refreshed I feel.
Mm, a slumber party, baby.
What? That's not what I said.
Get out the
chocolate mousse.
Duct tape.
Oh, get out of here, you freaks.
Geek Radio Daily. One 15-minute podcast provides 15% of the USDA recommended daily allowance of geeky goodness. Subscribe through iTunes or visit geekradiodaily.com.
Hi, this is Ann Lockhart, and you're listening to Screen Geeks Radio.
And we're back with our Screen Geek Director Series of the Week, or the month, or however long it takes. It tends to take us some time. Right now we're talking about David Fincher, and today we're talking about his third film, The Game, which came out in the fall of 1997. Michael Douglas plays Nicholas Van Orden, millionaire, cold, lonely, depressed, not very happy. His brother, Sean Penn, gives him a present, something from CRS, Consumer Recreational Services, a game of which you, the audience, and Nicholas Van Orden have to spend the movie figuring out what exactly it is and how you play. That's the setup for those of you who have not seen the game.
And if you're scared of clowns, be prepared to be freaked out for about 5-10 minutes. So this is the third film. What, first two, Alien 3.
Alien 3 and then 7.
And 7. This was follow-up to 7. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. I think a good way to start off talking about this movie is saying that this movie is... I swear I don't want to backtrack to anything we talked about earlier.
It's okay.
But this movie is for him what Unbreakable was for Shyamalan, because expectations were high and people didn't – and this movie completely thwarted expectations. You know, after The Sixth Sense, people were not ready for Unbreakable, which is now considered a classic. When this movie came out, you know, it was all over the poster from the director of Seven. People really were not ready for a movie that is certainly not as gruesome, not a horror film, and – ends in a way that you, without giving anything away, is optimistic.
It absolutely is. Because I was talking to Steph about this. She's like, you're going to watch this movie at some point. She's like, why? I don't like dystopian movies. I'm like, you know, this movie does send you down that path, but it kind of pulls out at some point. You know, pulls up into the happy land. Yeah. You know, this movie, actually, in many ways, this movie is more timely than any of his other films. Mm. If you think about, oh man. If you think about the advent of alternate reality gaming, the marketing campaigns for The Dark Knight and for Halo 2 and all these things that were just kind of messed with your perceptions of reality, this is the movie that did it over 10 years ago? Yep. Come on. I mean, this really was a groundbreaking film in that respect.
Well, for $25,000, there apparently is a real game, though considerably less dangerous than the one in the movie, but apparently there's something just like this that they do in real life for $25,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Ethan, what did you think about this little film?
I thought it was good. Yeah, it was funny. I hadn't really remembered ever seeing trailers for anything. I didn't know that much about it. So it was good. I just didn't know what to expect. And though I'm just glad the movie kind of was all very psychological in a way, and at some point for some reason I thought like it was going to involve like weird lizard creatures chasing Michael Douglas around or something, but it never resorted to anything like that. So
okay, that this in many ways this is my favorite Fincher film because it amps up the psychological factor, I think, to a level past Seven in many ways without resorting to the gore that Seven had, and that's a remarkable feat. I think it really he really had to flex his creative muscles on that one. Because when there's blood or something that you, even if you don't show all that blood like he didn't do in Seven, it still gives you an out to kind of give the audience something to latch on to. This was something completely from scratch, and in reality, it's a pretty ludicrous idea for a storyline. But he makes you buy into it completely.
One thing this movie got criticized for when it came out was that even though it's considerably less violent, either viscerally or psychologically, than Seven, it's certainly one of the most sadistic films he's ever done, because unlike Seven or Fight Club, there's no comic relief. This movie is as humorless as Nicholas Van Orton. It is very cold. It is merciless. And the negative term is that people said this is the most mean-spirited film that he's ever done. I don't know if I go that far, but there is something to say about this film. I remember when it was over... last time I watched this movie was with my mother, and I remember she's like, that is one of the... She's like, that really left a bad taste in my mouth, because it is... a lot of people walk away from this film very depressed because it is so relentlessly gritty and mean and tough, and the ending doesn't necessarily give the release you'd want either, because it's so in despair, this film.
I went to the IMDb boards after I watched this movie, and it was like a thread with the ending, and pretty much all sucked, so... Yeah.
I don't know. I love the fact that it ended that way, because that took even more balls than trying to make this movie in the first place, I think. And Michael Douglas is amazing in it. I mean, you say there's no humor. There is one scene of humor, and that's when he's talking to the guy on the TV. That was hilarious.
It's a great scene. Great scene. Love that scene.
Yeah. But you're right. Outside of that, there's really no comic relief at all whatsoever to be had in this movie. So it is a gripping movie. It doesn't kind of grabs you by the collar and won't let go until the end. But I loved that. As soon as it was over, I stopped. It was the first DVD I ever rented, actually. I actually went to our local like video store, rented a DVD player and that movie, and I had to start it over right away. So this is just amazing. Sean Penn's great in it, and it's his role is very interesting.
I love it because you see three different aspects of this character. He's got three very different scenes, and he plays this character who is strung out, who is a recent drug addict, who recovered. So I love that you get to see three different sides of this character. This is not a one-note part. I think it's interesting. It's worth noting that originally this part was going to be played by Jodie Foster. Jodie Foster was originally cast as the Deborah Ungar role, as the waitress who becomes part of the game. And in talking with David Fincher, she says, well, I'd really love to play the part of the brother who introduces the game. So originally she was going to play Douglas's brother, and that was going to happen. It ended up falling apart because she had some reshoots on Contact to do, so she had to bow out. But of course they worked years later on Panic Room. But it's strange. You never would think to put Douglas and Penn together as brothers, but it works beautifully.
And I brought up the alternate reality gaming thing before. This movie really benefits from the exacting detail that David Fincher demands in his movies. Because if they didn't explain every aspect of how this corporation was able to pull off what they did or didn't do, there was an explanation that made a lot of sense. If there wasn't, you couldn't buy into this movie and you'd write it off because of lazy writing or whatever. But there's so much detail about how every single detail by the end of the movie works out beautifully.
Yeah, and a thing I liked about it is, like, unlike Vanilla Sky, they don't just have a guy have a 10-minute explanation of everything in the movie.
Yep. No, you're absolutely right. You basically have to ascertain what the rules were, just like Nicholas Van Orton does. The movie, I think it works best if you accept it as a fantasy, because this is a Christmas Carol. The story is a Christmas Carol. And a lot of people say that the ending is a cheat. The first time I saw it, honestly, I thought, okay, the ending is a little jokey, especially when he shows the T-shirt. You know, it feels like this almost feels like a happy ending that was added on. But no, the movie does play fair. And in reading the book Dark Eyes, the films of David Fincher that I showed you that I've been reading, it was a textbook on his films. The one thing that Fincher, this is a direct quote from him, he says, like, I don't want you walking away from this movie, you know, with any other question than just asking yourself, what would your game look like? Because the whole notion of this movie, that you'll believe it or you won't believe it right away, is that the game anticipates every one of your possible moves. And that's why the ending works as it does, because they anticipated everything that Douglas was going to do. They had backup plans, of course, when he was unpredictable.
They even say it in the movie, even.
Exactly. They were on him because they took, you know, supposedly the psychological tests that they made him go through were so complete and so exacting that they anticipated that he would go from point A to point B to point Z. And that's why, you know, when you walk out, Fincher wants you to ask, well, what are your fears that you would have to confront in such a horrible way? And if you had survived them, you would probably walk away feeling a better person, feeling like you could really accomplish something in life. Van Orden has to deal with the death of his father, has to deal with thoughts of suicide, thoughts of drowning, and you know, fear of clowns, all sorts of things. So I guess
fear of losing the one thing he had stability in, his money, that stuff.
Exactly.
So well.
Exactly. All these things that his comfort zone were brick by brick pulled away from him. Fincher was saying, like, he's like, for example, if you're afraid of flying, he's like, you know, boy, I'm sure we could come up with a game for you. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because I've always been kind of afraid of flying, but would my version of a game being a plane that's
catching,
like,
on fire and you have to jump out with a parachute,
careening to the ground, and I have to deal with it, but hey, it's okay, it's all a game, and at the end they're gonna, you know, so
how Michael Douglas's character is afraid of Mexico.
Well, I think that goes with his alienation, because this is a guy who's used to being alone and not needing help, and all of a sudden he's in a foreign country where he absolutely needs to rely on somebody else. The Deborah Ungar character is like, you know, she's the game piece where, you know, not only does he need her to survive the game, but she's like the first person really in his life at that point where he's actually said, I need your help. I can't do this by myself. I can't buy my way out of this problem because I have no money.
Or when he opens up the briefcase and there's all those special pictures.
Right.
Just, there's just so much stuff that just Fs with you the whole way through. And what I really liked is that essentially this is a two-man show between Deborah Ungar and Michael Douglas.
Yeah.
And they pulled it off beautifully.
Mm-hmm.
I can't recommend this movie highly enough. I can't think of anyone who wouldn't like this film if you like movies.
It's dark. You know, it's Fincher and it's dark. And this is Fincher, you know, right before Fight Club. So this is again, a movie made by a young filmmaker who certainly wanted to push people's buttons and deal with darkness and certainly, you know, deal with some messed up stuff. And he wants you to walk away enlightened but disturbed. If Benjamin Button proved anything, is that he's certainly, I think, more hopeful. His worldview is more hopeful. Even Panic Room shows a man who is more hopeful. And that's the, you know, the difference also between Seven and Zodiac. Seven is incredibly cynical. Zodiac, it doesn't have a happy ending, but it's certainly, you know, it shows that there...
He has more faith in humanity.
Life goes on, right. In the sense of these movies, life doesn't really go on. The game, maybe, but 7 in Fight Club, no. Life sucks. You die. You suck.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, this is one of these movies where it's you know, very, very 90s nihilist. But again, it does have an ending that suggests otherwise, and hopefully we're not completely giving the ending away.
I hope not. But so. Yeah, this is a movie that's well worth checking out. It's like $10 at Best Buy. It's incredibly cheap. It has no special features. It has like the trailer and that's
it. That sucks. So this thing needs a making.
There's been rumors for at least 5 years that Criterion was going to do an edition of this, but nothing's come out about it. Apparently there's like a version out of the UK or Germany or France or something, if you have a region-free player, that has a ton of special features.
That it's like John Carpenter's They Live. There's supposed to be like this deluxe edition overseas, and here we got nothing, not even a trailer.
Yeah.
Hate that.
Do you have any closing thoughts on the movie at all, Ethan?
Not really.
Okay. I know you're tired, so
it's a good movie. It's a good movie.
Yes. And next week we are doing Fight Club, right?
Fight Club.
That should be fun. Yeah. The movie that is many people's Fincher entry drug.
And it's a lot of people's favorite movies, I find, especially young film students in my class. I always hear Fight Club.
Interesting. Cool. All right. Well, before we can get to that, we got to wrap this episode up first. So let's go talk about what's hitting theaters this week. There's some good stuff this week.
District 9, the long-awaited District 9, a movie that needs no introduction, but here it is anyway. Supposed to be good. Let's hope it's as good as they say, because man alive, everybody's calling it the second coming. A movie that I really want to see. I hope it's great, but it's been shelved for 2 years. I don't know. Eric Bana and Rachel McAdams and the Time Traveler's Wife. I think it looks
actually
like a good movie.
You know the reason why it was delayed, right?
Officially, I heard it was because Bana played the bad guy in Star Trek, and that he shaved his head, and they had to do reshoots for some scenes, so they had to wait for his hair to grow back. Is that what you heard?
Yeah. That's crazy, isn't it?
Okay. I hope that is the case. I seriously do, because I want this movie to be good. I think it looks good. You know, I'm all for chick flicks for guys, and I think Julie and Julia fit that bill perfectly. But if this is a really good, you know, science fiction romance, I'm all for that. I liked Christopher Reeve in Somewhere in Time. This looks similar to that, so I'm hoping for good things for Time Traveler's Wife. The rest of the week, who knows? The Goods, Live Hard, Sell Hard with Jeremy Piven. Funny looking trailer, could go either way. A movie I'm not expecting anything over. Vanessa Hudgens in Band Slam.
When the only press you're getting for this movie is like pictures of her hoo-ha,
Really?
Oh yeah, there are movie websites that have been posting like flasher pics from her. I'm like, really? How is this movie news in any way, shape, or form?
Are you sure it was a movie website, Dave?
I don't want to call the website out. That's just not cool to do.
All right.
I'll tell you after the show.
So, Band Slam, moving on. In limited release, you've got Miyazaki's Ponyo, which I've heard is wonderful. If I'm saying that right, Ponyo?
Yeah, I think it's Ponyo. I'm seeing it Tuesday night. I'm kind of torn because I want to see it in the subtitles, and this is a dub. But still, it's Miyazaki on the big screen.
But isn't it like Matt Damon and some really good actors dubbing it?
Yeah.
So, hopefully that'll be good.
Yeah, that's right. You know who's in this movie?
Matt Damon.
I can't let that go without using
that clip. That's right, man. You can only use it so many times.
No, you can't. You can use it infinitely.
It Might Be Loud, the documentary on the electric guitar featuring Jack White and The Edge and a number of other prominent guitarists. Looks like a really fun movie. And crap title of the week. I've not seen this movie, but you know I've seen the poster and I've read the synopsis. Film starring Jordan Ladd called Grace, about the stillborn baby that comes back to life and murders all who messes with his binky. Grace. Looks like such garbage. I was offended.
I've heard it's based on a true story.
All right. Well, wow, that just is so scary.
Always happy to end on a high note. All right. DVD releases. What do we got for the week of August the 18th? Hannah Montana, the movie. Currently on its way to making $80 million. Oh, well, at least it doesn't have one of those pesky Jonas Brothers in it. Dexter, season 3.
I'm in season 2, and it is such a good show.
It's quite the show.
Yeah.
One of the worst films of the year, the remake of The Last House on the Left. Josh and I saw this together at a preview screening. You know how Josh is about horror movies. Even Josh hated this movie. This is such a piece of garbage. Stars Monica Potter and Tony Goldwyn, for those who are interested. The Simpsons, season 12. The cover's got the comic book guy on it. I just want to buy it because he's on the cover. What do we got? Ooh. Okay, now on some interesting stuff. Jennifer Lynch's Surveillance, which we mentioned before, Bill Pullman and Julie Armand, one of the most effed up movies you will ever see. You could put that on the DVD box and quote me, because, man, that movie is so seriously twisted. Tyson, James Toback's documentary on Mike Tyson. I've heard this is really good. In fact, I've heard it's the best thing Toback has done.
Cool.
A movie I remember fondly from my childhood. I shouldn't. Boy, is that going to get me in trouble. Hope my mom never listens to this. Because of HBO and Cinemax, a series of movies with the words Hard Bodies in the title. Hard Bodies and Hard Bodies 2. You know, but honestly, I've only seen the second one. Ollie Oxenfree, that's all I say about that. Hard Bodies Collection, now available on DVD. No extras, just the movies. If you buy this movie, you're clearly not a serious film enthusiast, and you're obviously not buying it for a commentary, so might as well just buy it for what it is. Pete's Dragon, the box office flop of 1977, Disney film, part animated, part live action, with Helen Reddy, Red Buttons. I love this movie.
It's a fun movie. It's not a great movie by a long shot, but it's fun.
And Mickey Rooney. I haven't seen this since I was a little kid, honestly. I don't know. In fact, I remember it was kindergarten. It was the last time I saw it. But I used to watch it daily every day. But I don't know how it holds up at all. Finally, the release. Man, oh man, I want to buy this right now. The Last Starfighter, the 20th anniversary edition.
Is it 25th?
I think it's 25th. Am I wrong?
Yeah, you said 20th.
I'm sorry, 25th. 25th. Came out in 84. 25th anniversary edition. There was a really good DVD release of it the last time out.
But, yeah, I still got it.
Yeah, it was good. And Lance Guest actually like hosted that making of thing. It was fun. But apparently this says more.
Cool. So hey, I'm up for a double dip on a good movie like that.
Heck yeah. Well, you know, next year everybody's going to be buying Tron again. So
yeah, I'm happy with my 2-disc.
Yeah,
that works for me.
It's awesome. It even has the deleted love scene. It's like, what else do you want?
Yeah.
Unless they have the actual Tron game on it. You know, like the old school, like an arcade
game.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah.
That'd be pretty sweet.
If it's on a DVD, it wouldn't work that well.
That's true.
Yeah.
We'll see.
All right. Well, do you have anything to say about any of those releases at all, Ethan? I don't want to, like, stomp all over you.
No.
Okay. All right, then.
Ethan is halfway back to La La Land.
We'll hurry up so you can go take a nap.
Okay.
All right. Finally, before we get out of here, we have got some mail. This is from Mark Smith. It says, hey, guys, I love the podcast and have been listening for over a year. And wow. I must say, I love the dynamic you guys have with Barry and Dave being the older, wiser movie geeks. And Josh, Ethan, and Melissa being the young movie geeks who are just beginning to tap into the world.
I disagree with that.
I especially enjoyed this perspective over your Joe Dante series. Anyways, a fun thing I like to do with fellow movie geeks is get a list of shame from them. I know Dave just crossed off the Seventh Seal. Mine includes Jaws and Seven Samurai and a few others. It'd be nice to hear from you guys some of your shameful entries. So, Ethan, do you want to address, and I'll let you do your list first?
Okay.
And you... No, I'm sorry, Mark. We're retiring Daniel Plainview for a while because... Because Ethan's sick
we
of doing it, so
that
yeah,
joke. We did it too much.
It's still funny, but I don't want it to get into that bad, not funny territory.
Right, we want it to be sporadic and
we don't let it age like a fine wine.
Yes, exactly. We don't want it to be like a catchphrase that just dies.
Yeah, yeah. What happened? So wait, sorry. Go ahead, Ethan.
Okay, well. I can safely say I've never seen Wayne's World 2.
Oh, and that's it.
That's your list of shame right there?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, I do have a movie that's kind of goofy like that, and that would be The Goonies. You haven't seen The Goonies? What? How can you be a movie guy? Blah, 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 blah. And then I list off like 15 movies. Have you seen these? And then you'll be quiet. But I still need to see it. The other three that I've got are The Graduate, Apocalypse Now, and Double Indemnity. I've had this on my Watch It Now queue for like 3 or 4 months and still haven't gotten around to watching it.
Man.
So those are the big ones off the top of my list.
I think you'll really dig Apocalypse Now. I look forward to hearing what you think of that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
What was that, Ethan?
Sorry, we woke him up for a moment. For me, well...
Before you get into this... The fact that you have a list of shame is going to surprise people.
No, I do. I've always wanted to see Ordinary People, won Best Picture. I've never seen it. I've seen 8.5. I can honestly say that I've read books on Fellini, but 8.5 is the only Fellini movie I've seen. I've never had any desire to go there. You know, all the movies about his fear of women and the circus and filmmaking, for me, 8.5 was enough. I haven't gone back, but I need to, because I'm told he's one of the greatest filmmakers.
And there's another one on my list, Rashomon. I've heard I just absolutely have to see that.
Actually, that's awesome. I can give it like a serious answer just off the top of my head.
If you want to.
12 Angry Men, On the Waterfront, North by Northwest.
Oh, great one.
Are you going off the AFI list out of curiosity? Because that's
where
I went for that's where I went for my list. I'll be totally honest.
Yeah, I've never seen Rob Reiner's North or.
But have you seen the Saturday the 14th movies? That's the true question.
That's right.
Yeah, I know.
You know, I haven't seen any movie with the word with the number 3 in the title that came out in 2007. I didn't see Rush Hour 3. I didn't see Shrek the Third, and I didn't see Pirates of the Caribbean.
What about Spider-Man?
Oh God, I did see that one. That came out that year. Never mind. Wow.
Wait, does Bourne Ultimatum count?
No, because it doesn't have the 3 in the title. But very good, Ethan. Wow, you've totally woken up over there.
What about Ocean's?
Ah, very 13th. Good. Man, listen to you. Yes, see, that also came out the same year. Man, listen to you.
You're a liar.
And, of course, you're the one to call me on. It's very good, man.
Well done. All right. Well, if you'd like to send us an email and have us give a half-assed, not-so-serious answer, by all means, I don't know. Hey, that's why I put Goonies on my list. Shoot us an email, podcast, Ethan, Barry, Dave, Josh, or Melissa, all at ScreenGeeks.com. You can also leave us a voicemail at 719-553-5664. And we're actually going to do like another Fincher episode next week. No interruption. So, yippee. Talking about Fight Club, the movie that woke up people to who David Fincher is.
And who Tyler Durden is.
There you go. Yes. Yes. But until then,
but this is Tyler Perry.
This is Barry.
And it helps if I put the right music, like the outro music as opposed to the intro music.
Huh?
Yeah, my bad. It's all good. Until then, this is Dave.
Barry.
Ethan.
See ya.
You've got a little sister called Katie who once used all your Batman comics to decorate her cardboard car. And unable to salvage the comics, you drove the car into the pond, hitting your head on the concrete fountain, which is where you got your scar.